Hello, this is Amanda DeCadene, and you're listening to a special series I'm doing of The Conversation called About the Men. This episode, I'm speaking to Charlemagne the God about parenting daughters, how therapy changed how he sees himself in the world, intergenerational trauma, rape culture, and why men need to express feelings. Warning, Charlemagne discusses sexual assault in this episode. I hope you enjoy this one. Let's talk about some stuff.
Let's do it, Amanda. I'm with it.
I normally interview women, and I'm doing a series interviewing men. I'm going to talk to you about a lot of things that are to do with your perspective with masculinity and mental health and a range of stuff. But one of the things that you've said is your motto is bite my tongue for no one. Is that still true?
No, that was a Biggie Smalls verse that I've always loved. He said, how did the verse go? He go, bite my tongue for no one. If I said it, I meant it, bite my tongue for no one. And yeah, at one point in my life, I think I did feel that way. But then, you realize biting your tongue is kind of like measuring twice. So you only got to cut once.
And ain't that the truth?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of different instances that has happened. But, one in particular that I remember is, with my oldest daughter, when she was younger, she's 14 now, but when she was like, oh man, this might've been like 9, 10 maybe, cause she was running track at the time. And I remember being at one of her practices for track and she was doing the long jump and it was just practice. It literally was just practice. Like it was just practice. Hey, you want to do the long jump? Come try it. And I remember her doing the long jump and I remember just me going, yo, that was terrible. And she just burst into tears. And my wife was like highly upset at me and,
highly upset. I can imagine the mother of 15-year-old twins. I can imagine if that's kind of thing like my husband would say, I would be highly upset as well.
And she was only 9 or 10 at the time, but it was like, and then my parental ego kicked in. Cause I'm like, like we tell the truth in this house. Like there's no need to lie to her. But I realized it wasn't about lying. It's just that you see what your words as a parent can do to your child. Like your words have the ability to empower or they have the ability to devastate. I mean, I know that firsthand. Just, that's shit. 95% of the reason I'm in therapy is because of the things that my dad told me growing up. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So I was going to say, as kids who grew up without parents having that kind of awareness, same with me. I've been in therapy for so many years and relearning how to speak kindly to myself. Cause that's not what I grew up with either.
Yes. So, I mean, bite my tongue for no one. Nah, that's definitely not something I live by anymore. And, it'll bother you too on a professional level. Cause on a professional level, you're this person who has garnered this reputation for being outspoken and, saying what's on your mind. And what you quickly realize is if you're only doing that because people expect it of you, then you've become a caricature of yourself. And everything you say is performative and not real anyway. So it's just like, I do measure my words now and I do think twice before I say things.
So how do you maintain your integrity and not abandon yourself in work situations where there's quite clearly people are fucking up all the time. People are making choices that are dishonest. We work in the entertainment industry. It's not the most righteous, business to be a part of. So how do you navigate that side of things?
Oh, I have no problem having those conversations. You know what I mean? The conversations that actually will make a work environment better or make people in the work environment better. Like when I don't like certain things, especially when it comes to the culture of radio, because I love radio and I hate how the culture of radio is right now. You know what I mean? Only because I feel like the culture of radio has allowed itself to, play second fiddle to entities that just took the best parts of radio and amplified them, like podcasts. They took personalities and amplified them while radio ran away from having personalities. You know what I mean?
Right.
Radio took, took all the personality out and made all of these stations jukeboxes, right? And music was the star. But now in a world where you have all of these streaming services and I can pick whatever song I want to on demand, and in a world where, podcasts are showing personality is king. It's like a radio has just kind of like sat idly by and allowed that to happen and hasn't really, you know, done anything to counter that. And I'm vocal about that all the time because I care about the culture of radio. Things like that, I don't bite my tongue for. The things I bite my tongue for is like, you know, not knowing what a person may or may not be going through.
Yes, very much so.
And being so quick to have an opinion about that person.
I always say to my husband, like, read the room. Yeah. You know? I really appreciate your willingness to be vulnerable and to share your story. Why did you make that choice to share so much of your private life and your personal journey with the public?
I mean, I think for me, especially when I started going to therapy, it was just more, it was more of a cry for help than anything. You know what I mean? Because it was like, you know, I can't get on the radio every day and discuss other people's lives and what they got going on and not talk about what I got going on. And I've always been a very, you know, transparent person. I've overshared, you know, too much in my career. But I think it's a difference between being transparent and being vulnerable. And I think also I find strength in numbers. So when you're sitting around and you're telling your story about dealing with anxiety, dealing with depression, going to therapy, and then you start hearing from so many other people who are doing the exact same thing and going through the exact same thing, it just makes you feel kind of like sane.
It does, doesn't it? It really does.
Yeah, so for me, it's just more so like, it was a cry for help, but then it was just honestly like, yo, when I come to the radio, what else am I supposed to talk about? I didn't go to college, so I don't have an area of expertise that I can rely on. All I have is my life and my life experiences. So
same. I have the same thing. I went to juvie instead of high school. So that's my life experience is what I got to share. That's it. You know, but I, when you said the difference between sharing and vulnerability, you are vulnerable. I find your storytelling about yourself vulnerable. Would you agree with that?
I think more so now. I think definitely after therapy, yes. Before therapy, I was just being transparent because I didn't even have any emotional attachment to any of the things that I was sharing. Like, I always had no problem sharing every aspect of my life, every single thing that I've been through, but I never had any empathy towards myself or any empathy towards anybody I might have been talking about who shared these stories with me in my life. So they were just me regurgitating stories that I had experienced, but I never stopped and actually thought about, well, how did this situation make me feel? And, you know, why did I react this way? After therapy, I became a lot more, you know, introspective. Like, I've always told the story about being molested, you know, when I was 8 years old.
I heard you tell that story and it was very matter of fact. And I thought, well, you've obviously processed this out in therapy because you're able to tell it from a very mindful perspective at this point of your life.
Now, but before I would just say, yeah, I used to get molested when I was 8 years old by my cousin's ex-wife and I made her stop because I didn't like the smell of her Jerry Curl.
Yeah. And you said you didn't think there's anything wrong with it because you enjoyed it. Which I've never heard I've never heard anyone say that publicly. And I was so fascinated to hear you say that publicly.
Yeah. And I mean, that was just my thought process. That's actually something I'm still processing in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? I'm still processing that because especially being that I meet so many other guys and I know so many other guys who've had the same exact things happen to them, you know, at the hands of older women. And like, we all looked at it the exact same way. That's why I remember watching the Antoine Fisher story and was like, that wasn't my reaction. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, eventually it was though, because eventually I was just like, I don't want her to touch me anymore. But in my mind, I processed it because I didn't like the smell of her Jerry Curl. But the reality is I just really knew what she was doing was wrong. Right.
But do you know how many men it gave permission to that you told that story? Talk about strength in numbers. The fact that you shared that perspective publicly gave a lot of people permission. I remember, like, when you did that, I heard other men talking about it, and I think it opened the door for a lot of people to identify.
Oh yeah.
Right. But which yours didn't happen to be, but still, the fact that you did that gave permission to a lot of people to connect with their own experiences and their own trauma. It was really fascinating to watch, I have to say.
Yeah, that's the one. both anytime you're dealing with that, you know, whether it's a man doing it to you or a woman doing it to you as a man, like that's where therapy really does come into play, because you know, you'll beat yourself up. You know what I mean? Like there's men out there right now who are dealing with, you know, men touching them when they was kids, and they're blaming themselves. And like a lot of times that they project with what you would call toxic masculinity, because they try to overcompensate, you know, for being, for something that was out of their control.
How did it affect you as an adult, the fact that you were sexually assaulted as a child? Did you overcompensate in any areas?
I probably did. That's something I've been trying to process, you know, in therapy, just looking at my life and looking at the aspects of my life that where that probably impacted me in some way. I think it probably gave me a lot of trust issues. And I think it appears more now that I'm a parent, you know, and I think, you know, like things like I don't let my kids stay over nobody's house, which is like a real big point of contention between me and my 14-year-old. And, you know, you don't want to plant negative seeds in their head by saying like, and I'm sure I've told my 14-year-old what happened to me when I was younger, but it's like, you don't want to plant seeds in their head like this is going to happen to you. Like, you don't want to even go down that road or speak that into existence. But I'm sure that as a parent, that's one of the reasons I am the way I am, you know.
You that question, whether your own experience has affected your parenting, because I was sexually assaulted as a child as well. And that has really impacted my parenting to the point where actually right before I got on the Zoom with you, my 15-year-old was texting me saying she wanted to get an Uber or a Lyft. And I'm extremely paranoid about that. That's the kind of thing that like I deal with because of my experience. And I'm so pleased you spoke to this, because there's so many parents that have this experience of being assaulted in some capacity. And then we're trying to parent and not put our trauma onto our kids, and understanding generational trauma and how it gets passed on. And yes, you're right. You don't want to speak it into existence, but you also don't want to be asleep, because we know the world we live in.
That's right. In my second book, Shook One, I have a whole chapter called Parental Paranoia. And it's just the anxiety you experience being a parent. Like an Uber or Lyft, there's no way. Absolutely. I don't even like, even sometimes I remember we was in Texas and I didn't want my wife and daughter getting into an Uber, because, you know, she's a competitive cheerleader. I didn't want them getting into an Uber just to take her to cheerleading practice, just because I had already, you know, psyched myself out by reading all of these stories of sex trafficking going on in Texas and people getting kidnapped.
Exactly. And then you read the reports of how many people are actually sexually assaulted in Ubers and Lyfts, and actually think about what's really reported. It's bound to be way higher than the number that we know about. So I don't know. I have not worked out how to navigate this kind of parent paranoia with parenting. I really haven't.
Me neither.
I do not know.
When you figure it out, let me know.
You are such an advocate for therapy, and you launched the Mental Wealth Alliance. Can you describe what that organization does?
Yeah, you know, the Mental Wealth Alliance is an organization I founded. I actually founded it during COVID because I had a good friend of mine, Tim Shriver. You know, he's always been very impressed about the work that I was doing in the mental health space. And he just basically was like, look, man, if you're going to do it, you should really, you know, do it for real. You know, he was like, you know, you're always donating money to various organizations and, you know, helping other people's organizations, you know, raise money and bringing awareness to them. It's just like, yo, why don't you just create an organization, and then you can be like that.
The
that
other people can donate to as well and help grow.
And you can facilitate the other people, right? And I was like, you know, you're right. And then I was talking to Dr. Alfie Breland Noble, who runs the organization. And, you know, we came up with these three pillars, which is teach, train, and treat. And one of the things we want to do is we want to help over 10 million Black people get free therapy over the next 5 years. And we want to help increase the number of mental health professionals that are Black, because we need culturally competent Black mental health professionals. Like right now, I think the number is only like 3 or 4%. We want to get it to 13 to at least reflect, you know, the population of Black people in this country. And, you know, we want to get like social emotional learning in the schools and mental health literacy in the schools. And we want to, you know, help get legislation, you know, passed to get more mental health resources to, you know, the people who need them. So that's literally what my organization is about. Like,
yeah, that's wonderful. That is really, really wonderful. And it's actual tangible tools, right? To say, here you go, you know, and understanding what the problem is and then where you can help fix it. And that's multi-layered. I mean, that's incredibly aspirational. And I know that there's going to be, you know, that is a long game, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's my life's work. I've never done something or been a part of something that's more fulfilling than, you know, when people come up to me in the street and say, hey, man, I started going to therapy because of you. Or somebody's family member comes to me and says, hey, man, my brother, or my uncle, or my cousin, you know, they started going to therapy and, you know, started really dealing with their trauma because of you. And I stuff like that is like, man, that means everything to me, you know? So anybody that's doing the work, you know, I try to amplify. Like I just recently in my hometown, there's a guy named Jay Barnett. He's a psychiatrist. He has this great tour called the Just Heal Bro Tour. And it's like him and four other brothers, they just go to different communities and, you know, all the men come out and they just sit there for a couple of hours and just pour into these men. And it really helps a lot of these brothers, you know, get on their healing journey. And we had like 200, 300, you know, brothers come out to a Mount Moriah Church in North Charleston, South Carolina, and just vent. And, yo, you'd be shocked at things that men, you know, open up about when there's a safe space for them. So,
yeah, we need more of those safe spaces. Absolutely. We really do. What are the barriers that Black men face when they're trying to find mental health support?
I think the biggest one is just finding culturally competent, you know, therapists. Like for me, when I first was on my journey, I purposely was not looking for somebody Black. And the reason I was purposely not looking for somebody Black is because I didn't want somebody that might have some of the same biases that I have, or that might share, you know, some of the same prejudices. I wanted somebody that didn't understand my experience at all. And the reason I wanted that is because when I shared these things that I wanted to share, you know, I wanted to see what their reaction was going to be. Like when somebody relates to you about something, then you've both created like this sense of normalcy for what it is that you're discussing. And you know, I wanted somebody who could just objectively look at everything I was presenting and just help me unpack it.
You've got a really good therapist, haven't you?
I do.
I can tell.
but what I also have is access to a lot of good people, meaning people that aren't necessarily my therapist, but they're my friends. So they do this work. And so I cheat a lot because, you know, I have my regular therapy that I pay for, but then I have friends that I actually just speak to, and they're not just therapists and psychiatrists. Same. They're people in the spiritual world, like, you know, my homegirl Debbie Brown, who works for, you know, Deepak Chopra. Like,
yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, so it's people like that I get to communicate with on a regular basis.
Okay, I'm just gonna make a recommendation of someone for you to read that you might not know. Is, do you know Terry Real?
No.
Okay, you got to check him out. He has a book that he's written, many books, but the one that just came out is called Us. And he talks a lot about toxic individualism and about how capitalism is a part of that, about how we are not communal. And he talks, he has something called relational therapy, which is the therapist brings their own experience to the session, which I love. And he's phenomenal. And I think you would really like his work.
Just wrote it down, Terry Real. I'm looking at his stuff right now.
Yeah, he's exceptional. So when you were 30 years old, your dad disclosed to you that he had struggled with anxiety and that he had been on like between 10 and 12 medications at one point, and it was also suicidal at one point. Describe how you felt when you heard that for the first time.
Man, it was actually when I was 40.
Okay.
Yeah.
Big missing piece.
It gave me, it allowed me to give him a lot more grace. Cause you know, the first time I ever cried in therapy was literally realizing how much issues I had with my father, how many daddy issues I had. You know, I thought that I had issues with my pops just because of, you know, him and my mom getting a divorce and, you know, how that played out. You know, he ended up with another woman. And, you know, I just, I had a lot of resentment towards him for that. At least that's what I thought it was. But then I realized it was deeper than that. Like, I actually realized that my father used to punish me for things he never taught me. Mm. So it's like there's this unwritten rule, I guess, when you're a father, that your son is supposed to be just like you. That's your junior or whatever. But, you know, if you don't teach him anything, like, how is he supposed to know? And there's always this one. There's one story I always think about. I had just got my license and I was following my dad. So I'm driving, right? And he's driving. He's in front of me. So I'm following him. And so it's like he runs the stop sign. So I ran the stop sign going onto the highway. The highway was Highway 50.
As you would.
Yeah, I'm following him.
And yeah. So
he pulls over on the side of the road. I pull over. He gets out and he smacks the shit out of me, like, pow. Like, and he's like, wake up. And I remember, like, I mean, first of all, the slap hurt like hell, but I just remember him hitting me. And I just remember I started like laughing hysterically like the Joker. Like when the joke, like,
you
like,
were confused, like, you were in shock.
Exactly. And I just always remember that moment. It just serves as I'm following him. And I'm like, I remember sitting in therapy thinking, like, and you know, he would always discipline me like that, but be upset at me for things he never taught me. Mm. And I remember that was the first time I cried in therapy. So I like, you know how that is too. When you start going to therapy and you start unpacking stuff like that, you start hating that person even more.
Yeah.
I went to that, a period where I was like, I can't.
That's the first part, isn't it? Because you connect to that piece. Yeah.
Yeah, I could.
The last piece is the compassion and the forgiveness.
That's right. And I was like angry at him for a while and he didn't even know it. And then I was home for Thanksgiving. And I remember I had a cousin who completed suicide. He had tried to commit suicide four times. He completed it on the fourth time. And between that and my book, my second book, he started talking to me. He just told me. And I remember when he told me that, he was like, man, you know, I tried to kill myself when I was younger. And, you know, I was on 10 to 12 different medications. I was going to a therapist 2 and 3 times a week. You know, then they just started giving me a check. And I remember asking my mom, like, yo, you know, Dad was getting a check, you know, for his mental health. And she was like, I just thought he was playing crazy to get a check. That's literally what she said. I thought he was playing crazy.
Oh, wow.
So
she was in her own denial.
Yeah. So it just gave me a lot of grace because I realized he was just a man doing the best he could. And he had his own issues that he never got a chance to truly heal from. And the only other thing I wished after that was I wished he would have shared that with me when I was younger, because I remember when he used to talk about the devil coming to get him. And he used to sleep with a knife and a gun by the side of his bed. We used to live in a single wide trailer. So he used to sleep with a knife and a gun by the side of his bed because he literally thought like the devil was out to get him. But that was just anxiety. You know what I mean? Like he was just, he had substance abuse issues because he was trying to escape something.
And he was trying to self-medicate his anxiety, probably.
Exactly. And so
I
just wish I would have known all of that when I was younger, because it would have, when I started dealing with my anxiety at a young age, at least I would have known what it was.
Yeah. And maybe there's someone that you could have said, oh, I'm having this experience. And even though he did, it sounds like he didn't really find solutions or tools to help him, but at least it wouldn't have felt like you were in a vacuum.
That's right. Like my daughter's in therapy now.
Yeah. You know, same with mine.
My oldest daughter, she's 14. She goes to therapy. And you know, the reason we put her in therapy is because I remember being that age, you know, and I remember being that age and like being forced to figure things out on my own, you know, because at that age, you know, even though my father was really big on discipline, like I said, he was dealing with a lot of his own issues. So he was in and out of the house, whether it was rehab or whether it was him just creeping around on my mom. So it wasn't like I was being micromanaged, you know, with my oldest daughter.
Well, he wasn't able to parent.
Yeah.
Because he was dealing with his own stuff. I was going to ask you how your own upbringing has affected your parenting, because I don't know if you've had this experience, but for me, this has happened to me multiple times where I found myself saying or doing something and I'm like, motherfucker, I'm doing the same thing that I said I would not do because it's part of my programming. Have you had that experience?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's the yelling, but I'm not a disciplinarian. So like I used to get beatings. Like I used to get like beatings. I was the guy, I had to go pick my own switch. You know, my dad would beat me with an extension cord and make me go take a bath. Like that type of, I'm talking about Wu-Tang Clan torture tactics, you know? And like, I don't put my hands on my kids, you know, but I raise my voice and I just have to always be very aware of when I do, because, you know, I don't care how much therapy you do, how much healing you do, how much meditation you do, kids try your patience. You know what
oh
I mean?
Oh my God. There is nothing more challenging to bring up your issues than kids.
That's right.
And maybe a long-term partner, of which I have both. And so that's my experience.
Same. And you know, kids try your patience. And you know, I have a 7-year-old who is, she's a girl, but she's like me in a lot of ways when I was that age. And she can come off very disrespectful and, you know, not listening to her parents. And like, then there's this other part of me where, and this is strange, but it's like, I grew up poor. So I didn't grow up the way my kids grow up now. And like a lot of us have this need for whatever reason to try to like instill the struggle in your kids.
Yeah.
And I don't.
Because you don't want them to be spoiled, entitled kids.
Exactly.
That's another affliction.
Exactly.
Who wants their kids to be like that?
Exactly. And so, you know, like even last night, I snapped at my 7-year-old because like she had a thermos full of fresh water sitting by her bed while she was going to sleep. And she was like, I need you to go get me more water. This water isn't fresh. I'm like, I just put this water in here. And it was like, it was just the way she said it. I don't know if it was late and I was tired, but I'm just like, I'm your daddy. I'm not your butler.
Yeah, I don't work for you. That's what I say to my kids.
Fire
yeah.
That's what I say.
Yes.
I don't work for you. I
yes.
love you. You know, and I'm going to always provide for you, but no, you got to say please. And
yes, you know. And your legs work. You can get your ass out of bed and go get yourself some more water. I, you know, it's weird. I heard that, there was a video that was going around a few days ago of Britney Spears, you know, really speaking to her kids, her sons in a way that, you know, I guess her ex-husband thought it would be shaming on her, but I listened to it and I was like, oh no, I get it.
Well, I heard that too. You I know? Said the same thing. I was like, what else is she supposed to say to her boys?
Exactly. That's you're parenting that's teens.
Right. And she's a mom. And
she's a mom. So she gets a level of disrespect. That's even more. That's I mean, right. I know, cause I see how my kids are with my dad, their dad versus me. So, you know, I think, yeah, there's that aspect of, where's the line between like you're just parenting and you're immensely challenged, right, by kids, which everybody is. And then I look at the fact of like, wow, my kids are just having a different experience, you know, and it is a hell of a lot better. The hope is that each generation, it gets better enough so that at some point, the impact is as small as it can be. But here's my question for you. No matter how much therapy and recovery and all of the stuff that I've done, there is still a tiny little piece of me that always feels like I'm always going to be living with this. I'm always going to be compensating for the breaks that happened when I was a kid, the psychic breaks that happened, right? It's always going to be in me. Is there ever a point where I don't have to self-regulate, where I don't have to think about the words I'm choosing? I don't have to look at my reactions. I don't have to meditate twice a day. Like the amount of shit I have to do just to like be right with the world and myself. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, this is exhausting. Is it ever going to be any different? Do you ever think that?
Yeah, I think what you said earlier is so true, and it's something that I remind myself of. Like, man, we really got to be kind to ourselves. Like, you know, I beat myself up for, you know, things that happened when I was younger, and I do overcompensate. I overcompensate in you know, just making sure I'm treating people, you know, correctly. I'm treating people the way that I want to be treated, especially, you know, my wife. Me and my wife been together 24 years. You know, we've been together.
Congratulations. I just hit 20 years, and I really, when I say congratulations, I know what work it takes to keep growing with someone over a long period of time and to have career changes and kids
right.
in different stages of growth and both parties to grow. Like, I know what that takes. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And to you both, because I know that it's her too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think about times that, you know, I haven't done right by her, and that will drive me crazy. And, you know, but it'll make me show up, you know, in very unique ways as a husband, you know, in very unique ways as a partner. Cause just, and I tell her that sometimes, like, man, I just apologize for
mm-hmm.
things we did when we were kids. You know what I mean? And I just,
sure.
I apologize. It just makes me want to just be the right man right now.
You've said that having daughters helped open your eyes to rape culture and the objectification of women. In what way specifically has that happened for you?
You know, I think, you know, having daughters, but also just getting older and, like, you know, listening to women, you know, when you, especially when the whole rape culture term came about, like, you know, what is that? Like, what is rape culture? Like, I remember we were asking that question, and when you listen to women and you hear them say what they believe rape culture is, I do think the word rape is a very harsh word for some of these things that they're describing, but I understand what it is that they're describing. And I could even understand, you know, the role that, you know, I played in it, you know, and I mean, this whole culture, this whole American culture, the role that American culture, you know, plays in it. And a lot of the things that...
Specifically male culture.
Yeah. And a lot of the things that they normalized, you know, growing up, that falls under that umbrella. And so for me, it was just like having daughters and, I mean, having daughters and a lot of women friends, but daughters in particular, it just makes you, like, really, really pay attention. Because for me, it's like I want to be a part of the change that's going to make the world a better place for my daughters. You know what I mean? And make the world a better place for, you know, the women around me. And I think that just starts with listening. Like, honestly, just opening your ears and listening. I think a lot of times, you know, men get defensive. Like, oh, no, that wasn't me. Or I didn't do that. Or no way. I would never, push something like that or be responsible for something like that. But if you just listen, you're like, oh. Okay, I get it now.
Well, that begs the question of, I believe that it is possible for people who have made really poor choices at a stage of their life to become aware that those choices were really detrimental and to take ownership of them and to change the course of their lives. How do we make it an acceptable conversation for us to at least be open to the idea that someone can make a bad choice and take ownership and grow from it? I know multiple people who have really learned what they did was not okay and have literally changed their lives from then on out and were of immense service to people in the world because of what they realized. And right now we don't have an opening for that to happen, which I think is a real shame.
Yeah, I don't know where that happened. I don't know when the door closed on grace. I really don't. I don't know when the door closed on, you know, forgiveness. Like growing up, the first book my dad ever gave me was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And the reason I love that book so much is because the book was such a testament, you know, to growth. Like, that book is what showed me that growth is possible. That book showed me that, you know, you can always transcend your circumstances. That book showed me that, you know, you are allowed to make mistakes. And I grew up in an environment where, man, I knew so many brothers and sisters who were a part of the Nation of Islam. That was the whole blueprint of the Nation of Islam. Like, you know, they would take the worst amongst us and make them the best amongst us. And, you know, we all were allowed to make mistakes. I don't know when we got to this place in society where everybody was so perfect and nobody made any mistakes ever in life that they could be so judgmental of the next person, you know, who made a mistake. And truth be told, man, if we didn't give people grace, who would we have left?
Exactly.
I'm talking about everybody. Like, I'm not men, women, who would we have left if we, you know, just reduced people to their worst possible moment? Like, who would be left?
That is the case today, unfortunately. And it makes me so sad, because the people who have overcome and who have struggled and who have made fucked up choices, which practically everybody has to different degrees, those are the people who have a wealth of experience to share with so many other people in their communities, in our world, right? That's how we grow and learn, is to be able to hear stories and to reflect our experiences and go, wow, God, okay, I didn't think of it like that. Or, wow, you've really helped me to see things differently. And we just don't give spaces to people who have when culture decides someone's fucked up, they get ostracized and we can never hear from them again. And I think that we're doing humankind a massive disservice to not allow those people who have the perspective that is valuable to now be able to speak somewhere.
Yeah, and I think the only reason that door gets closed is because we the people are afraid to talk to those people. So when we see the internet, that's really where it comes from. It comes from that online outrage. When we see the internet, you know, make somebody radioactive, then nobody wants to have a conversation with that.
They don't want the radioactivity on them. And if they go speak to them, it's going to leak onto them. It's fear.
I think they're more fear. They're more afraid of the backlash they'll get from just even having a conversation.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm starting to have these conversations in a way that I'm comfortable with, because I think it's so important. I also want to speak to people outside of the echo chamber.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. And I think you should. I think it's imperative. But once again, I tell people all the time, like, you have to give other people grace, because if not, we're in a circular firing squad.
Exactly.
Eventually, it's going to be your turn. Now, imagine being a certain age, you know, you've grown, you've evolved, and then somebody pulls up an old tweet from 20 years ago. How do you can't even explain that, because you're like, I'm so far past that.
In fact, if you think about it, what we are saying to people growing up today is like, you better be perfect. You better not put a foot wrong. You better not say anything wrong. You better have all the communication down. Like, you better be a fully developed grown-up by the time that you're out in the world, because anything you do and say you put a foot wrong will be held against you forever. And who can live with that pressure?
Nobody can. And that's why you wonder why these kids are committing suicide at the rate that they're committing suicide at. It's because, yo, you've created this unattainable bar of perfection that nobody on this planet has.
Nobody, which is why I think it's so important that we share truthful, authentic stories, because no one is perfect. It's just impossible. I don't even use that word with my kids. You've said that you don't think masculinity is anything now. You did say that, right? I just want to make sure you said that.
I said something to that effect. And I still believe that.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I know masculinity wasn't what I was taught. Masculinity to me, I was taught when I was like 17 years old, confronting my pops about cheating on my mom. And, you know, he looked at me and said to me, oh, you only got one girlfriend? You know, one day you're going to understand. And like, I remember him saying that to me, and I'm talking about it took 17 years for me to not think something was wrong with me.
Yeah.
Because I chose to be committed to one woman, you know, and it almost became like a ego thing. Like, you know, I used to like for my pops to see me with different women.
Sure.
You know,
well, that's how you got validation and respect from him. That's what he taught you.
That's right. Only for him to turn around when he got older to tell me that was the worst mistake he ever made was messing up with my mom.
Wow, thank God he told you that, though.
Yeah, it was freeing. And then telling me, like, you know, I love that, you know, you've been with the same woman for so long. And, you know, and I was just like, she'd have told me that 17 years ago. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have made a lot of the mistakes, you know, that I made. But it's just like, yeah, most of the things they tell us about being a man really are just raising a generation of sociopaths. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of things that, you know, they teach you about manhood, like in the sense of like providing and, you know, protecting your family, that are very valuable. But a lot of the things, like just sucking up your emotions, not being allowed to cry, not being allowed to be afraid, not being allowed to be sad. Like some of those things, they just tell you just to suck it up and keep it moving. Like that's not good. You're literally teaching a generation of men how not to feel.
Yeah.
Like you can't deal with your emotions in any way, shape, or form. That's why I said you're raising a generation of sociopaths.
How do we change that? That's a big question, I know.
You change it by doing what we're doing now, like having these conversations.
Yeah.
You know, letting people know that it's okay, letting men know, hey, it's okay to cry. Letting men know, you know, if it's okay to like be overwhelmed, to be frustrated, to be afraid.
And to not express it through rage and violence, to express it through communicating and vulnerability. When you get to the root of it, it's always a feeling of vulnerability, you know?
Yeah, it's us projecting pain. I think a lot of the violence that happens is just because you got an individual who has a lot of unhealed trauma, who has a lot of hurt, who has a lot of pain that he just ends up projecting on somebody just because that person may see them, or they think that person sees the real them. Like they don't want to be seen as vulnerable. That's why we put up these shields.
The masks.
That's why we put up these masks. That's why we give ourselves nicknames, and we become these caricatures, these personas, because we create these characters and personas to protect the real us.
All right. So let me ask you then, you gave yourself the name Charlemagne the God. Is there a point for you where you feel like you're going to call yourself Leonard?
Well, yeah, that's why I do it now. You know, I call it, it's Leonard McKelvey.
Leonard.
I say that a lot more now because...
See, that's my English way of saying it. Leonard. Leonard.
Nobody around me calls me Charlemagne. Like, my wife don't call me no damn Charlemagne.
Oh, no, that would be weird.
Yeah, my mom does. Like, nobody that truly loves me, even my close friends, like, they don't do that. They might say Charlemagne, like if they're, now I'm not talking about my family, but like my close friends, if they're talking to other people.
Sure, because otherwise people don't know you as Leonard.
Exactly.
Like, who are you talking about? You
know? But for me, it's like, yeah, I had to break free of the character, like, because I'm not afraid to show up as myself. Because the person I'm talking about is Leonard. Leonard needs his childhood wounds healed. You know, a lot of the times when you hear these conversations, most of the time, these conversations are coming from the perspective of, you know, Leonard, like the Charlemagne person, character, you know, is still somebody that is a part of me for sure. But I don't need that character to protect Leonard as much as I used to. Mm.
Well, I want to thank you for showing up today and bringing all of you to this conversation. It has been such a treat to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Appreciate you so much.
I appreciate you. Have a good rest of your day.
All right. Peace. Thank you.
Bye.